So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up tomorrow on the program, it's your Friday News Buzz. Among the several items we'll be covering on our quick-paced set of conversations tomorrow for our News Buzz, a vaccine is being developed by an Ames company to combat the worst Ebola outbreak in history. We'll talk with someone from that Ames company developing that vaccine. We'll also talk with former astronaut Clayton Anderson about his space flight workshop at Iowa State University and a new study on how pot smoking affects driving. Pesticides linked to declining bee and bird populations have been found in streams across the upper Midwest, and it's raising yet more concerns about these chemicals' environmental effects. Researchers from the United States Geological Survey tested waters at 9 sites here in Iowa, also in Nebraska. They found neonicotinoids in each. We'll talk about what those are. Frequently at levels that may harm insects and life that depend on insects. The findings are the latest in a fast-growing body of research that highlights the environmental threats posed by neonicotinoid pesticides, which are now the world's most widely used insecticides. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is currently conducting a review of neonicotinoid use. Joining me now to talk about these concerns, Mary Harris is with us in our Ames studio, adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Entomology and the Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Mary Harris, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Dana Colpin is with us, research hydrologist with the United States Geological Survey, co-author of this study that found widespread concentrations of neonicotinoids in Iowa's water. Dana Colpin, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, since this is the data that you've been looking at. Where were the sites that you tested in the Midwest and in Iowa?
Yeah, we sampled a number of sites across the states. We didn't want to focus on any one part of the states. We have like the Little Sioux River, the Iowa River, Maquoketa River, Nishnabotten River, and then the big border rivers, the Missouri and Mississippi rivers that we sampled last growing season on a monthly basis, and then a local site, Old Man's Creek near Iowa City, where we did hydrologic-based sampling. So basically every big rain event through the growing season and low-flow events, we collected water samples to get a better idea of the temporal concentrations that we were finding in streams.
Going in, what was your idea about what you were looking for?
Well, we just thought we'd look at these insecticides that really increased their use of late as they started to replace the older carbamates and OP insecticides. These are growing in their use. And so there really wasn't much data available on their occurrence across the country. So Iowa and the Midwest being a region where these are probably one of the heaviest use areas in the country, they thought this would be an area to start with in terms of just determining how prevalent are these compounds in the nation's streams and just kind of focusing initially in the Midwest.
Let's talk about what you just mentioned there. I don't know if in layman's terms we can understand what has been happening in terms of insecticides, pesticides here. Is that something you can get across to us as people who are not in that industry, what that change is?
Yeah, it seems like, you know, there's been a replacement of the older insecticides, particularly the OPs, where there was noted there was some potential environmental effects. So these were a newly developed class of compounds that have just were growing in popularity. And it seems like my understanding is the use with these newer insecticides, there's a big component of the use is with seed treatment. So a lot of the seeds, both corn and soybeans that are planted, are already treated with the insecticides and fungicides to kind of give a boost to the crops.
Mm-hmm. Mary Harris, can you piggyback on that about what these new neonicotinoids are?
Sure. It was a new chemistry that works on a certain neurotransmitter reception site in insects that is less sensitive in mammals, so they had really low mammalian toxicity. They're also water-soluble, which actually create some of the environmental problems, but it allows the plant to take the chemical up and distribute it throughout the plant, giving the plant protection from insects that would come and chew on the plant. So it had a new chemistry, which meant that the insects that had developed resistance to the carbamates and organophosphates were not resistant to this new chemistry. So it was a big boon in insect control.
Mm-hmm. Neonicotinoids, thankfully, they also have a shorter name, neonics, I understand. Mary Harris, how do you see these results, what's being measured with the neonics in the water during the growing season? How concerned does it make you?
I'm very concerned, and I'm not surprised at all. As I said, these chemicals are very water-soluble and move in surface water and in water that's under the surface. They also have significant persistence in the soil up to 3 years, and they are applied in great quantities now throughout the corn and soybean growing regions. They're also used as seed coating on wheat crops and canola as well. So throughout the world, as was stated, they are the most widely used insecticide, and they are not limited in their effects to simply pest insects. They are toxic to pretty much all insects.
Mm-hmm. So, and the concern here, and you mentioned earlier, they do not seem to have harmful effects at these levels to mammals, humans, and other mammals, but the invertebrates are the ones we're worried about in this case. The insects, also invertebrates, what, worms, snails, other types of things like this. So why are they, and how do these neonics affect these creatures?
There's little information right now on how they affect worms and snails, mollusks, other invertebrates. There's growing information and studies on the effects not only on honeybees, which most of the information to date has been the study of the effect on honeybees, but other insects, including aquatic insects, which are the basis of the food chain for a lot of other organisms.
Mm-hmm. If you have questions about pesticides in our waterways, you can ask them. Mary Harris is with us, as well as Dana Colpin. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, or go to our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or tweet us at IPR Talk with your questions. So the most research having been done on how honeybees or bees are affected by these neonics, these chemicals, what can you tell us about the effects? What's been going on?
With any toxic chemical, there are both acute effects and chronic effects. Acute effects result in death, either right away or over a few days. Chronic effects include developmental problems, learning problems, which bees have to learn a lot about their environment, navigation so that they can get back to the hive. And there is growing evidence that neonic exposure increases their susceptibility to disease. So there's quite a lot of belief at this point that exposure to neonicotinoids is contributing to what's been commonly known as colony collapse disorder.
Mm-hmm. So we do see the connection, because that's been going on for years, the great mystery. And I guess I haven't been keeping up on how much of this mystery is being unlocked, is being solved. So are these chemicals definitely a contribution to the colony collapse disorder?
I think anyone is going to be reluctant to say definitely. All we can do is provide scientific evidence that the bees are being exposed to these chemicals and that the effects are quite negative. So in the study that I've been conducting, I'm in the second year, looking at the pollen that bees are collecting during the time immediately prior to planting corn, the weeks in which corn planting is most intensive, and then the few weeks following corn planting, the bees are collecting pollens that are heavily contaminated with neonicotinoids when corn planting occurs. The pollen that they collected prior to corn planting had no evidence of neonicotinoids. And the effects that this has on a honeybee colony coming out of winter can be quite severe. This is the time when they're trying to build up their numbers and start producing brood for the coming season. And if the workers are going out and bringing back heavily contaminated pollen, not only are the workers eating that pollen, which can have acute effects, but they're feeding that to the developing brood. So these chronic effects can have quite an impact on how well the hive does over the season.
Mm-hmm. It certainly sounds like it could be a contributor, a culprit here with colony collapse disorder. Are there any other possible culprits out there that are contributing to the collapse of our bee colonies?
It's believed that there are a number of contributing factors. Exposure to other pesticides is probably one. Also, varroa mites, which are essentially a bee blood-sucking parasite that also has the ability to negatively impact the immune system of bees, is likely making them more susceptible to disease, along with the stress of moving hives across country for commercial pollination service.
Mm-hmm. Having just biked across the state the other week, I was struck by the very few number of butterflies I saw, Mary Harris. Is that something possibly connected with that, or just I just want more butterflies out there, right?
Well, I want more butterflies. What I want is to see butterflies like I used to see butterflies.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
All and over the place. And those milkweeds full of the, not the worms, what are they?
The monarch butterfly larvae, yeah.
The larvae, yes.
Yeah, that's another environmental problem that I think is impacting.
Okay, so I'm trying to get in a long-winded way to if butterflies are affected here.
We only have circumstantial evidence in terms of long-term studies that have tracked numbers of certain butterflies and how those butterflies have declined along with the increase in use of neonicotinoids.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the unanswered questions here. Dana Kolpin, after this study, what comes next for you as a research hydrologist in this area?
Well, certainly I think we want to really get a better understanding is how important is the seed treatment aspect of these neonic use. I mean, the results we showed that they're definitely being transported, you know, combination of their long persistence, their water solubility, but really can't nail down how important is that seed treatment aspect. And my understanding is
how important it is to agriculture.
How important it is to contributing to what the concentrations we've seen. Obviously, the amount of use that's being applied is going to have an effect on how much we're going to see in the stream. So we know seed treatment is a fairly new, at least a growing component. But really, to say is that the contributing factor why we're seeing the prevalence of these compounds in streams or not? So that's kind of one of the research questions I think we really want to go after.
Is it unexpected that these are finding their way into our waterways? Should they have been staying in the plant since they're water soluble?
No, given their chemical physical properties, it's probably not surprising that we are finding them. But again, I think it's just the aspect of how they're used. The dynamic of the use has really changed maybe from previous years or previous historical applications, whereas more the broadcast applications and so forth. So this seed treatment aspect, you know, even though it's more kind of the precision farming rather than broadcasting across the entire field, they're treating each individual seed with, you know, low levels of these pesticides. So really, again, trying to get a better grasp of is that a driving factor to what we're seeing?
Dana Kolpin is with us of the United States Geological Survey. He's a research hydrologist. Mary Harris is with us of Iowa State University, where she's in the Department of Entomology and the Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management. Let's go to some callers. Let's talk to Jim. Hi, Jim, in Story City. What are your concerns as you listen to this conversation?
Well, I'm wondering if there's a way that we can have water tested. We have a pond. My young son and I were watching the life develop in this summer, and one day we went out and it was basically everything was dead, the tadpoles, and it was associated with a neighbor spraying some aerial spraying, and it made me wonder if there could be a connection between the two. So
I'm sorry to hear about your pond. That would be sad to see all the life die off in a pond. Mary Harris, so react to that.
Well, I don't think that the neonics would have killed the tadpoles, and they wouldn't be spraying neonics in the crop. So it would be something other than the chemicals that we were talking about, but it could be associated with the spraying. As far as getting your water tested, there are facilities that will test, and of course the cost of that test goes up with the greater number of chemicals that you would be testing for. Something that is difficult with neonics is that it is prohibitively expensive to test for them. There is not an affordable test. It's a couple of hundred $100 to have a sample tested. Mm-hmm. So I think one thing we need is a better, more affordable method of testing for these chemicals.
Jim, thank you for your question from Story City.
Thanks.
And let me talk to you, Mary Harris. Have we seen anything like this in the past? Does this remind you of anything in the past that we could?
Oh, yes.
Oh, it does. Okay.
Rachel Carson coined Silent Spring, where DDT was affecting not only the insects out there, but birds, and affecting the eggshell thickness. So they would essentially crush their own eggs while they were sitting on them. And she coined the term Silent Spring because we were not hearing birds anymore. And in addition to the lack of butterflies that I've noticed over the last 5 years, the number of songbirds in my yard has greatly diminished. And there are studies coming out, particularly one in the Netherlands, in which neonicotinoids have so suppressed the prey base of insects for their songbirds that they are directly relating neonicotinoid use to declining numbers of birds.
So my hypothesis would be what you're saying is that our songbirds, other birds, are starving.
It very well could be. Even seed-eating birds, when they're feeding young or they're migrating up from their wintering grounds, will forage on insects. And if there aren't insects, they don't have much to eat.
What about our bat populations? They depend on insects as well, of course.
They do. I don't think anyone has looked at the connection between neonics and lack of prey for bats.
It sounds like there are a lot of unanswered questions. What other questions do you want the answers to, Mary Harris?
Well, recently, a meta-analysis came out looking at yield effects of using these insecticides. The purpose for reducing pest pressure is to maintain high yields. And they looked at all of the large commodities that have treated seeds, and they found very few instances of yield increases associated with the cost of putting this seed treatment on. They did find that where pest pressure was really high, the seed treatments were effective and did boost the yield. What I would like to see is that we return to the practices of integrated pest management, where we only use insecticides or fungicides when we know that we need them. So if we don't have the pest insects out in the field, there's no need to keep putting neonicotinoid seed treatments on the seeds.
Mm-hmm. So there just seems to be this growing body of evidence that neonics are doing some damage to our environment, specifically to these invertebrates or insects and possibly all the animals that feed on our insects. What do you foresee in the future if these ideas about the problems with neonics are proven to be true? What would be the steps that would need to be taken, Mary Harris? Can we look back in history for the way forward there?
We can, and I think we need to respond to the increasing number of studies that are determining the non-target effects of these chemicals and weigh that in the perceived benefits that we are gaining from using these chemicals. And that is for the EPA to pursue.
Mm-hmm. An email from one of our listeners, from Bruce. I'll just read it. Does Mary Harris know why Australia, which uses the same pesticides, does not have the colony collapse, while Europe, which does not use the pesticides, does have the colony collapse of our bees?
Europe, which banned the use of this insecticide 2 years ago, has had some improvement in their colony loss numbers over the winter. Australia has a very different farming landscape than we have here, and where bees are kept, they produce bush honey in Australia, and the bees are not kept near agricultural fields. as commonly as they are in the United States.
Suzanne, very quickly, we only have a minute or so left. Can you make a quick question from Grinnell, a caller? Hi.
Oh, hi, yes. I just, you kept on asking about the surrounding effects on things like bees and songbirds, and there's been a lot of pushing in of trees and bushes along stream beds for agriculture recently. I mean, just very precipitously increased. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's decreasing the habitat for all of these natural wildlife.
Okay, Suzanne, thank you for that comment from Grinnell. That'll have to wrap up this conversation. I want to thank you very much. Mary Harris, Adjunct Assistant Professor in the Department of Entomology and the Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University, and Dana Culpin, Research Hydrologist with the United States Geological Survey, co-author of a study that found these widespread concentrations of neonicotinoids in Iowa's water in the Midwest. Dana, Mary, thank you for coming into our studios.
It's my pleasure. Yep.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll also talk about water quality. Earlier this week, we heard large amounts of algae in Lake Erie made the entirety of Toledo, Ohio's water supply unsafe to drink. Now the executive director of the Des Moines Water Works says the same issues could happen in Iowa. We'll address that tomorrow on our program. Also in our News Buzz edition on Friday, a vaccine we'll talk about being developed by an Ames company to combat what we've been hearing about, the worst Ebola outbreak in history. Also, a conversation with former astronaut Clayton Anderson about his space flight workshop at Iowa State University and a new study on how pot smoking affects driving. Jason Burns helped us out today in Ames. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.